Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this, what is today, Wednesday, the 30th of October. I was listening to the radio yesterday. I always listen to the radio, but there was I was listening to some BBC report somewhere, and they were celebrating the 25th anniversary of a program, asking the question of their various correspondents, what will radio be like 25 years from this very moment? And it got me thinking, wouldn't that be an interesting show to talk about where radio may be? I've been in radio for 38 years now, and when I think about what it was like when I started, there are differences, certainly, in how we collect news and the rapidity with which we can, and the speed and immediacy of news stories all over the world, but some of radio remains the same, the intimacy of radio, the habit that we form with radio, and it's hard for me to believe that in some form or other, it won't be around 25 years hence. So who did we ask to be with us? Jack Mitchell. Jack has been in radio for a long time. He listened to the radio greats, Edward R. Murrow and others, and what a life well lived. He's also received the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's Edward R. Murrow Award. You probably know him in Wisconsin because he developed the whole statewide network that we have for Wisconsin Public Radio, where he was director for a number of years. But he played a key role in developing national public radio and in creating All Things Considered. He has some wonderful stories to tell about the first days of NPR. So he has been in radio and is now teaching at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, but we thought we would ask him, what will radio be like 25 years from now? Will we still have radio? Well, welcome your phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email. There's something that's new in the last 25 years is talk at WPR.org. And heavens knows this is new, Facebook, although it's not new anymore. You can leave messages for us there on the Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Jack.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
Good.
Thanks so much for being with us. You know, I thought about that question when I heard it on the radio. I was thinking about it all day. And I don't know if I can answer it, but I think you've been asked the question before, and you say radio will still be around 25 years from now.
Or something very much like it, yeah. I think the thing that radio has that no other substitute has is the sense of companionship and the notion of just turning on something when you're not quite sure what it's going to be, but you know it's picking, depending on the station you like, it's probably going to be at least halfway interesting to you and maybe very interesting to you. Mm-hmm. And so this notion of a live stream of programming that you can tap into whenever you're available, I think that will continue. And probably not for other media, because almost every other medium requires you to do something and pay attention. Either you're on your computer or on your cell phone tapping in something. You have to pay attention to it, and you shouldn't be driving while you're doing that. Whereas in radio, you just turn it on and let it go, and you can put your attention to other things at the same time. Same with television. You sit there and watch something, you're probably not reading a book or washing the dishes or anything else. So the radio has this companionship aspect to it, which I don't think will ever go away unless we are all stopped doing anything else except focusing in on our video or our cell phones or whatever. And whether it may not be broadcast. You know, we right now, you're hearing this most likely through on the air through a transmitter around the state, but some of you may be listening online through your computer while you're at work or doing other things, and that may be what happens, is that all radio will move to the internet and the transmitters will go away.
Oh.
But I think the service, the notion that there's something interesting going on. Maybe it's music, which also you listen to while doing other things. Or maybe it's talk. But audio, that medium is used to accompany other activities, I think will go on indefinitely. So that's what I would consider broadcasting or radio streaming, audio streaming.
Right.
And so a program like the Kathleen Dunn Show will probably still be around. They'll still be doing those in 25 years.
Except I'll be dead, so
well,
I won't be doing it.
Somebody
will be doing the show.
Somebody will be doing it.
Right.
And so I think that will happen. The other difference, the other thing is the notion of getting something specific when you want it, which might be video, it could be audio. But that takes your attention. You have to, you know, go online and look something up, pull it down. That's great. It may be an old program, might be something that's very specialized, but that goes for video and other type of services out there as well. It's not a companion. That's not using it as a companion so much as going after a specific thing. And that will be another way for people to get audio material. And I'm all for it, but it's not going to be, that's different from the notion of listening while something is happening and somebody is talking to you while you're engaged in other activity.
Mm-hmm. I was interested, I've been reading a little bit about your incredible career today, and I think the year was 1965, you were getting your master's at the University of Michigan, and you chose radio. Everybody else, though, was going into television. And would it be fair to say that radio could have, that people were considering it a dying broadcasting form in 65?
Yeah.
Really?
Oh, sure. It was, well, dying. I think it had, nobody, I don't think anybody expected it would die, because that might have happened 10 years earlier when TV came in, which came in the big time in 1954, 55. And all the big shows moved from radio to TV. You know, Jack Benny used to be on the radio, then he moved to TV. All of the big entertainment shows were on radio. They just moved to TV. So why do you bother listening to radio? Well, radio adapted, and it moved to this idea of being a companion. Prior to that, you tuned in at 8 o'clock on Sunday night to hear your particular program, and this family sat around and looked at the radio.
Right.
When television took that spot and took over that function, radio had to change, and it changed to this companion-type service, which meant not so much individual programs as a consistent service that people can come into whenever they are available. And I think that had already happened by 65. But the real excitement, at least in non-commercial broadcasting, was television. Because this was new, and this was where the glamour was.
You've said all the smart people focused on TV. You, Jack Mitchell, were one of the few people under the age of 30 who said, wow, we can do something with radio. Why did you choose radio?
Well, partly because nobody else was doing it, but I always liked radio. I grew up on it. We didn't. I'm old enough that I remember the days when we used radio as our entertainment. At night, and we got our first TV set in 1951 or 52, I guess it was, when I was about 11. But for the first 11 years of my life, I was a radio guy, and even after television came in, I watched TV, but I did a lot more with radio. But there, in that case, you're kind of moving into your teenage years, and, you know, teenagers didn't want to be with the family watching TV. They wanted to be in their bedroom listening to the radio or something else. So, but I always liked it, mm-hmm. and it was partly the intimacy. In fact, I would say that's maybe the key factor there, is that there was this one person talking to you. And there was not that distance of between you and that screen. And there's a difference. And it's hard to tell exactly what it is, but I think you certainly understand it, Kathleen, and I think your listeners probably do, too.
Yeah, I think they do as well. And wasn't it incredible that you just happened to be born at the time when public radio, although you didn't know it in 65, but this whole new medium that fit your interest and your skills and your desire to do something important in the world was about to be created.
Yeah, I was very lucky. I mean, I look now and I realize that there's so many really good people who are seeking to have the kind of opportunities I had, and most of them never will, because there are other people interested. And it was pretty much an open field for me. And I realize now that as I think about it, is that there were other people interested in public radio, but they were interested in it in order to have their own program or to do whatever it was they wanted. And that never particularly interested me. I was really more interested in the idea of, can we build an institution? And we had very few young people who were interested in that, and the older people who were interested in it were kind of the rejects from TV, you know, those who had been in public or educational television and for whatever reason didn't quite make it there. And so, okay, we'll get a job, do it in radio. So it was a unique opportunity, and not only the right time, but the right place. Mm-hmm. I was born in Detroit, went to the University of Michigan. Michigan happened to be one of the few places in the country that had a significant educational radio station, but no television. And so the people there were very interested in having educational radio included in what was supposed to be just the Television Act, the Act to Create Public Television. And I didn't have much to do with it. I've got radio stuck into the act, but without anybody really having much idea of what might be done with it, other than just doing what they'd always been doing, because these folks were maybe 50 years old and had been in the business for 25 years, and they knew what they wanted, but it was kind of an old-fashioned thing. And so there were not too many of us. There were others, but there were only a few of us who were younger and sort of had a more we wanted to do something different as opposed to just doing what we were already been doing on a bigger scale.
And so you created this institution, which is phenomenal. I love the story. First of all, let's go to that year you spent. I wasn't aware of this, that you were at BBC in London for about a year. You were selected by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Right.
Did you get ideas there that you could put to use when you came back and formed this brand new institution, public radio?
Yeah, well, probably the biggest one was that while I was there in 1969-70, they were remaking their entire radio operation, which was interesting in itself just from a sociological point of view to see a new generation pushing out an older generation and a lot of human heartbreak in all of that. Actually, it was kind of very disturbing, but still interesting. It didn't affect me, so I, you know.
Right.
But just to watch it. But they changed, prior to this, the BBC radio had three services. One which was popular, very much like American radio, commercial radio, called the Light Service. Something called the Home Service, which was much heavier in terms of its content. Entertainment, but it was more high-level stuff, a lot of news and talk, news and documentaries and this kind of thing that was kind of had a more educated audience. The White Service had about 80% of the population listening to it, and the Home Service was much higher end. And then the third program, which was really high-end to the point that very few people listened to it at all, and they didn't care because the people who it was there for artists to express themselves and intellectuals to speak to other intellectuals. It was a really high-end thing and say a very little audience, but it was there. While I was there, they decided before, but they were implementing a plan called Broadcasting in the 70s, in which instead of having these sort of brow-level, intellectual-level distinctions between the three networks, they created four networks based on the genre. So there was a rock station, sort of a popular entertainment station, that's Radio 1 and Radio 2. Radio 3 was all classical music. And Radio 4 was all talk, from the most popular stuff, you know, the soap operas, to lectures that would have otherwise have been on the third program. And the idea was to have a range of interests within a range of intellectual levels within a genre. And they were still trying at that point to get the public to sort of educate. You know, somebody will tune in for the this kind of simple Save the Soap Opera, and they end up hearing a lecture by Albert Einstein. Now, that was the theory.
That's a good day.
Yeah.
Right. Why not?
Yeah. So so they went to these formats, essentially formatting Radio 1, 2, 3, and 4. And when I came back to the United States, I had that idea in mind and had written about it while I was over there. And said basically radios 1 and 2 are taken care of in the United States. Public radio in those days, or its main programming that people actually listened to, was the classical music. And that public radio should try to own classical music and really do a terrific job with that, because there was a market for it, if you will, and we already did it, and that we ought to develop then a Radio 4, which would be all talk and information. So it became known as the Radio 1, Radio 2 plan, which, and NPR, the idea of NPR was it would be the basis for the talk service, and that the stations could do the classical music on their own because they already were doing it, but that NPR's goal should be a talk service that's available through, all day, if right. we did it correctly. We started with an hour and a half, but that was the most important idea that I brought back.
Well, that's a pretty important idea. Jack Mitchell is our guest this hour. We got thinking yesterday after hearing a BBC show celebrating its 25th anniversary. They asked, what will radio be in 25 years from 2013? So we're asking that question of Jack. He was, of course, the director of Wisconsin Public Radio and had a vision of creating bureaus all over the state. So you hear us everywhere in Wisconsin, and if the signal is strong enough, in other states as well. He also played a huge role in developing the institution of National Public Radio and creating the program All Things Considered. What do you think? Where will radio be in 25 years? What do you notice as differences now from 25 years ago, and where is it now? What purpose does it serve in your life? I love talking about radio, so we're having a good hour. Well, welcome your phone calls. Our lines are filled. Just keep the number in mind, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's take phone calls for Jack. Our lines are filled. We start with Sally in Middleton. Hi, Sally.
Hi. I hope... You just faded a little bit, so I hope you hear me. I started out loving radio I'm a little bit older than even Jack. So it was the Lone Ranger and Duffy's Tavern, and the whole family listened in the evening. Daddy'd make popcorn, and we'd turn on the radio. And then I moved to Madison, and I couldn't believe the radio here. I feel like I've had a second education. I am a college graduate, but I've had a master's. It's the totality of it is excellent. It's not one angle of everything. As I say, I really do think Madison is unusually good. I don't know if you moved to Arkansas. Nothing against Arkansas, but I don't know if that would be available. But I'm so grateful that in Wisconsin, we really have the best of the best.
Mm-hmm. And Jack really, in large measure, helped create that. It is considered a great network, isn't it, Jack?
Yeah, helped is a very important phrase there, because it was the WHA and WLBL have been serving the state since 1920 or so, and they did wonderful things long before I arrived. They built the state FM network. That the core of the network was built primarily to serve schools back in the 1940s. But that function was taken over by television and now by online materials. So radio got out of that business quite a long time ago. But the notion of extending the university and the values of a university and promoting democracy, promoting the sense of a state and a state that can solve its problems by talking about them, that was critical to the thinking of the people that came long before I did. I'm doing research on a book about the development of public broadcasting in the state, and so I'm kind of into this right now. And there was a man named Professor Heine Eubank, who was a speech professor, a debate professor, and he took an interest in, well, he became the head of the committee that oversaw the stations for about 30 years. And, you know, he was interested in conversation and debate. He was, and thought that, you know, we could really make democracy better through radio. And his point was to have all sides of the issues presented, that we'd have the Socialist Party and the Progressive Party and the Republican Party and the Communist Party and the Prohibitionists all have their voice on the radio, and people could decide. And so public radio in Wisconsin was about the first, and for a very long time, the only broadcaster in the country that made a real effort for political debate on the radio, and we continue that. I mean, this is the Ideas Network, and my sense is sort of a continuation of that idea in modern framework.
And when she talks about receiving a master's degree and another one, and I think we do that on this network in an entertaining fashion, I can't believe all that we learn in the course of a month, Jack.
That's right. That's right. And it starts with education. I mean, one of the licensees of our stations is the Educational Communications Board, and the other is the University of Wisconsin Extension. Well, they're both educators, but it's not a stuffy kind of education. And H.B. McCarty, who was the director of the stations for about 30 years, from the 20s through the 60s, I guess that's 40 years, was very much an entertainer, and he believed that education and entertainment had to be go together, that strict entertainment is not much point to that. Education that's boring, it was not going to reach very many people, but that you could combine entertainment, not lots of jokes necessarily, but humanity.
Right.
That the sense of companionship could be combined and be more effective than anything else. So I want to be humble in a sense that this idea is been around a lot longer than I have been. In fact, long before I was born, they were doing that here.
Thanks, Ellie, so much for your call. Mike in Sun Prairie, hello.
Hi, two things. One idea would be to put a 50,000-watt clear channel transmitter over the border in Mexico for NPR. And the other one would be, you know, with AM radio, it's kind of a national asset, because if everything goes to the Internet and that Internet croaks, we're all going to be in trouble, and that's when AM would really shine.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there were, you know, talking about 50,000-watt station, McCarty, the guy who I was just mentioning, tried for years to get one of the Chicago channels moved to Wisconsin.
Oh, really?
Yeah, WMAQ. He figured, might as well take the best one, the biggest one. And see, because each state is supposed to have one clear channel station, and then based on population. And then Illinois had more than, they were supposed to have about three. And it ended up that most of the states around here have one, WJR in Michigan, Cincinnati, there's a big 50-watt in Ohio, there's one in Indiana, WOWO. All the states around here have one, except Wisconsin. We don't have one. And there are four in Chicago. And McCarty, reading the law, said one of those Chicago stations is supposed to be here. And they worked on this for many years. Never succeeded, of course. But so this was back in the mostly the 30s and the 40s. But they went, I think they tried again in the 50s, too. Never succeeded, but they never gave up either.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Mike, very much for the call. Jack in Eagle River, hi.
Yeah, hi. I go back to 30s and 40s radio, so I'm not brand new. But I remember fondly listening to the Rose Bowl on the radio and all the sports that was on the radio. Now on television, and of course you see what TV does with that. They dictate, you know, when the games are played and everything like that. And also I listened to soap operas when I was a kid, Ma Perkins and Stella Dallas. And
so did
like
I.
That. And, you know, it just, it was exciting, a lot of variety. And I think what's wrong today is rural radio is so bankrupt. If you can't get Rush Limbaugh on, you can't get radio. I mean, that's just about it when you drive across the country.
Right.
The only time you'll come across really listenable, interesting radio is if you're close to an urban area or a university. So yep. I'll close by saying that we get four public stations here, and I'm so thankful. We get Rhinelander, Marquette, Madison, and I think the other is Park Falls, something like that. And that really makes up for a lot of deficiencies to be able to get that many public stations.
Right. Yeah, we are very fortunate in Wisconsin to have that many because Minnesota has very good public radio, and that comes into a large part of the state. You're at Northern Michigan University has a good service. We have a couple of independent stations, the one in Rhinelander that you mentioned, WXPR, plus the two statewide network services from Wisconsin Public Radio, and in this case, it was really intended initially as a service for the rural part of the country. Instead of putting an FM station in downtown Milwaukee, they put it out in Delafield, which is considerably west of Milwaukee, and it's up way up high. And the idea is they could cover Milwaukee, and they could also pick up Whitewater. You know, it's just they were not thinking about so much serving urban areas as the broad agricultural and small town Wisconsin.
Thanks, Jack, very much for the call. We should include a historical footnote because this was certainly a big night for radio back in 1938, the War of the Worlds broadcast, which is quite a moment to remember. I've always thought, Jack, that certainly in my lifetime somebody would visit us from some other planet and they would be kindly and good and they would change everything for the better. It hasn't happened yet, but we remember that night. So we remember it every year on October 30th, right?
Right. That's right. And I that one I don't remember.
No, you weren't around
not,
for that.
Not quite, but it was, and we listen to it now, and it sounds like, well, how could anybody believe this? But
right.
When you think back to what radio was like back then, with its live band orchestras, everything live, it was more probable.
Let's go to Gene next in Washburn. Hello, Gene.
Hi. I've been wondering, ever since Neil Conan went off the air, you know, he made some very unreadable remarks about his reasons why, and I just kind of blew me away that I got the feeling that it wasn't really his choice. And so I asked my son to do a little poking around on the internet, and he went to the New York Times and came back and told me that the blurb that he found in the New York Times was that NPR had made an executive decision that Americans no longer wanted this hour-long, in-depth kind of programming, mm-hmm. which, you know, shocked me because, you know, that was one of my favorite programs. And then I see that WPR has gone to a lighter fare with, you know, it's got the 3 hours with the two kids, and it's good. But it seems to underscore what my son read to me out of the New York Times. Can you speak to that at all, Jack?
Yeah, I think so. NPR has never been enthusiastic about the hour-long call-in show. They did it they started talking to the nation somewhat reluctantly. back 25 years ago. It was around the time of the first Iraq War, and the idea was they wanted to just fill a lot of time relatively cheaply, so they'd be on the air in case something actually happened in Iraq. But it caught on. A lot of people liked it, including me.
I did, too.
And Neil Conan, I think, is excellent.
Superb, yeah.
So I was disappointed. But yes, you're right, in terms of NPR believed, they never quite believed in the show. And the people who, between us, who were making the decisions, frankly, didn't know a whole lot about radio, in my view. They're television people, and this has always been the problem with radio, where television people tend to run it, and they don't understand the intimacy and why Neil Conan, as a person, talking intelligently about things would be appealing. They decided to partly to save money. They invested a lot of money into some internet stuff that hasn't really paid off. And so they were in debt. And they said, well, we can just lop off this program and save whatever it was. And I'm sorry they did that. I wasn't too surprised that they did, knowing the priorities of the place. As far as WPR goes, I would not want to comment actually one way or the other. I think they do a nice job on with the Central Time program. I think both hosts do a nice job, and they certainly cover some good topics. It does move along faster, and you don't have the depth or at least the length of the discussions, and they're much more controlled so that there are no surprises, and they know pretty much what everybody's going to say when they get into the conversation. It is more contemporary. It does match better what people are doing during that drive time, which means in and out, not necessarily able to listen for an hour. It's a practical change. In the NPR's case, they weren't saving money. I'm sorry, in WPR's case, they weren't saving money because probably this program is more expensive to produce than an hour-long call-in show. But for NPR, they were saving money, and they weren't too thrilled with the idea to begin with.
Well, I wonder about what bothers me as a listener, actually, Jack, is that you lose the voices of America, or you lose the voices of Wisconsin. I love that. I love to hear people call in and hear the variety of opinions, and they're usually quite thoughtful people, and they disagree or they agree.
And there's such a range of them.
I know.
That's what's so interesting is that, to me, is that you'd never find a stereotypical Wisconsinite calling in, because maybe there is no such thing. But it's all kinds of voices and accents and ages. And, you know, obviously I like what is done on the Ideas Network. But it will probably change more. A lot of people were upset when we went to using call-in shows because we were replaced hour-long lectures, which are more substantial than a talk show. If you happen to listen to the whole thing and you're taking notes as you go along.
Exactly.
But radio, the talk format, allows an informal and less rigorous. You know, it's not a lecture.
Right.
And couldn't really take an exam on the Kathleen Dunn show.
Right. Thank goodness.
It's, because it's more episodic, but more spontaneous, and you never quite know what's going to happen.
So do you think that this will be a thing of the past, that hearing the voices of people 25 years from now, we won't be doing that?
I suspect we will, although I wouldn't guarantee it, because the with the internet and the certainly Facebook and the Twitter and those things, people are chatting all the time.
Right.
And perhaps there's less appetite for that, actually hearing the voices. I personally like it myself, and I'd hate to see it go, but there will be some kind of an information stream out there to dip into whatever you need to or want to.
Mm-hmm.
How much of it will be live? I'll say literally live, but how much of it will be with listeners call in? I'm not sure. Right. We are, you know, nobody has pushed this as far as Wisconsin did. Other stations will have a call-in show, maybe 1 hour or something. But we're the only place that has sort of made it the central feature of the network. And a lot of people think that was kind of a silly idea. I don't. But I think the consensus within public broadcasting is that people want a tighter, faster moving
yes.
kind of a format.
Yeah. Jack Mitchell is our guest. Gene, thanks for your call, and I share, Jack does too. I was sorry to see that show go off the air as well, and it's one of the reasons we asked to move to this time period. Not that we can put together, we don't have the resources to do a show like Talk of the Nation, but we wanted to preserve that call-in element and deal with some of at least the same issues. But I lament it's leaving the air as well. Jack Mitchell is our guest. We are asking the question this hour, except you have to look at the past to look at the future. Where will radio be 25 years from now? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our lines have been very busy, but there are openings right now, so feel free to take one of those openings. You can send us an email at talk@wpr.org or leave messages for us on our Facebook page, and that is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jack Mitchell is with us now. The future of radio is what we're talking about. Jack, of course, director of Wisconsin Public Radio for a number of years and played a very important role in creating the institution, National Public Radio, and creating All Things Considered from its very first days. He was the first producer of All Things Considered. Quite a story, isn't it? It's quite a story. And we're welcoming phone calls for him, 800-486-8655. Michael in Washburn. Hello.
Hi there.
Hi.
More of a vignette than a comment, but first of all, I'll say that regarding a couple callers back, my wife and I moved to the northern part of Bayfield County 5 years ago, 22 years ago, and one of the reasons we did is we get 11 stations here.
Ooh.
On public radio, yes, KUMD and OJB and so on and so forth. But the reason I called was I have my mother is 94, I'm 66, and we communicate by email twice a day. She's still living at home. And the War of the Worlds came up on Sunday night's old-time radio, which I listened to. And I asked her, I said, where were you when that came on? Did you listen to that? And that started a topic of conversation on radio. And the first thing she did, she says, yes, I was living with an aunt and an uncle, and we listened to it on Atwater Kent radio, which, of course, I immediately Googled and looked up, and there is an Atwater Kent, and how she remembered it 94 years later, I don't know, but you should Google it. It's quite a radio. It was 2-piece. He had a speaker that was remote and blah, blah, blah. But then we started talking about the next radio they had and the culture of everybody being around, and they didn't just sit and listen and look at the radio. They knitted, they read, they played games, whatever it was, but the radio was the focus of that entertainment in the evening. In fact, some of the descriptions are like read out of a Norman Rockwell painting. It's just lovely that she can remember for that. So my comment, if there was a comment here, is more, I don't know where we're going with radio, but I sure know where it's been, and I know what we'll miss if it doesn't exist in 25 years.
Oh, what a wonderful call.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's fine. I just said you were a wonderful call.
Oh, you're welcome. So I'll hang up and listen to
Thank you.
But
you.
Enjoying the program. Thanks. It's very thought-provoking.
Thank you, bye Michael. Bye. Thank you. That was a great caller. Jack?
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of them.
Yeah, there are.
I mean, that's the thing. That's what you know, Washburn, Wisconsin.
Right. Yeah. And the important role that radio played in and how it also sparked a conversation about history, too. Right. Oh, yeah. Thanks, Michael, very much for the call. Let's go to Alan Appleton. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm glad they moved you into the afternoon slot just to kind of break things up a little bit. You know, talking about Neil Conan being gone and then with Ben Marin's left, which I miss his show as well. And I traveled a lot down south this last year, spent most of my year down there, and they do have issues with coverage because of, like, in the northern parts of some of the states or in the mountains, you just can't reach people. But, you know, they don't have the same thing down there. What they have is national, or they play music, and they don't get to cover any topics like we have here. And what they're up against is either religious stations or the Rush Limbaugh stations, and they are everywhere throughout the nation, from Texas to South Carolina, North Carolina, all the way through there. That's, you just get a barrage of that and nothing else. And it's really hard to have conversations with people when that's all they listen to.
Yeah. And why, thanks for pointing that out, Alan. Why is that so prevalent, that kind of radio, Jack?
Well, it's, first of all, radio, like, well, television is getting that way too, but it's very fragmented. And so you don't go after a mass audience, you go after a subset of the audience, and you do that by appealing to their views and their prejudices. And so if Rush Limbaugh can reach 10% of the country by just throwing them raw meat, he will, and this will be successful. If you try to be more neutral or try to be more open, I mean, you're not going to be loved by you're not going to get that vitriolic kind of fan. So he's been very successful at that. You can argue that you don't have liberal people of the same success, and it may partly be that the kind of person that responds to that kind of anger, which is really what it is, tend to be on the conservative side rather than similar anger on the liberal side. I don't know exactly what, but it's certainly in the South and in the West, the public radio has never been very strong. It's grew up in basically the Midwest. It was the Midwest state universities, plus the big cities of Boston and New York, etc. But the South has always been a very poor area for public radio, and the stations down there don't have much money. They don't have that many listeners, so the cheapest thing to do is just import the material from NPR or other outside sources, and and playing records.
Yeah. Well, as you know, Rhonda, who I'm going to miss so desperately, is leaving at the end of this week. And I've been looking at what she has produced over 7.5 years and doing some reminiscing this week. And I think, Jack, I don't want to get sappy about this, but there's a place for that kind of radio. But I worry that all of these ideas of learning about more about presidents and how the history relates to today and artists and music and the ideas about global warming and immigration, all of these issues that we deal with, that there are learned people who we should be listening to. And that's how you learn things. That's how you become, by golly, an informed American citizen, not by listening to some guy, and it's usually guys, spout his opinion, which is pretty divisive and nasty. So it's troublesome to me that we don't have millions and millions of people who listen to the product that we give.
Yeah, it takes a certain open-mindedness, and people who have already made up their mind about anything probably don't care much for public radio, because half of the stuff they hear on public radio has got to be totally wrong. But it's people who have a more open-minded attitude, who actually want to hear other points of view and not just their own, there aren't that many of them. But they need to be appealed to, and they need to be fostered and not left out in the lurch with nothing.
Right. They sure do. Thank you, Alan. Jim in Wauwatosa. Hello.
Hi. Hi, Mr. Mitchell.
Yes.
Listen, Kathleen, you're swimming upstream. I mean, infotainment is where it's at. I mean, it's not going to be geared towards knowledge. It's just geared towards entertainment. And so the shock jock, the people, like, I used to listen to Neil Rogers in Miami. I mean, he would just dominate that market for 40 years. Rude, irreverent, nasty. People like that. I mean, people want to be entertained, unfortunately. So I just think you're kind of, I don't think that education is going to be marketable. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, well, I find entertainment interesting. I mean, information interesting. I don't find what he was listening to. I won't listen to that kind of radio. It just makes me sad. It just doesn't do anything.
Yeah, well, you're kind of strange, Kathleen.
Oh, Jack, I know.
Well, you're not typical. I mean, you are a kind of typical public radio listener.
Right, right.
But the fact is that the notion of educating by the mass media has been a long goal. The BBC did it and still does it to some extent. But they do it because they have a monopoly, or they did when they were very successful at it, because there was nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had to listen to their rather serious approach or turn the thing off. But then you give people choices, and of course they're going to go, many of them, to things that, well, they're all going to go to something they find interesting.
Of course.
But what most people find interesting may not be terribly substantive. And that's a reality. And other than chaining people, kids in school, you can make them listen or at least have the radio on while they're sitting there doing nothing else. We aren't kids in school.
Mm-hmm.
People have lives and they have freedom to do what they want. So, but there are enough people, I think, who do want something that's not boring, but that has some substance to
right,
it.
Right, right.
And even if it's a minority, it is a minority.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I say even if it's a minority, it is a minority. But it's a substantial minority, and so if it's 10% of the population, well, in Wisconsin, that's 500,000 people.
Right, and it's even Jim. Jim is listening to us, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Thanks, Jim. Let's go to Bill in Green Bay. Hi.
Good afternoon. I just want to go back to something Jack said about the Chicago stations, and among them was WGN, which led the nation, both, I think, in revenue and listening audience, for a good number of years in the 60s, 70s, and part of the 80s.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And now, then they went to a completely different format because of changes in ownership, and they started falling down. Got a new general manager, and his attitude is, I want the kind of people working for me that worked in the 70s and 80s, like Wally Phillips and Milt Rosenberg,
mm-hmm.
and some other people that just attracted people, a huge listening audience. And he's trying it out, and I don't know if it's going to work or not, but he has nothing to lose, because when you're at the bottom, you can only rise to the top.
Yeah.
And he does believe in, not only the light stuff, but a little seriousness
right.
at night, too, with Rosenberg.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, GN, I think, is an exceptional station. It you're right, back in the 70s, 80s, there was a lot of substance there. Not all. I mean, obviously, it's mostly there for entertainment. But I think GN was a great station. I haven't listened in a long time because it seemed to me kind of really did go downhill and nothing was very interesting to me. And it seemed to me that they lost some of their best people. And of course, that happened. They retired. They got old. But I'm glad to hear that somebody's trying to do something.
Yeah, we'll have to listen.
Yeah,
Jack, we're out of time. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Fun.
Yeah, it was fun. Yeah, thanks for all you've done and for your wisdom about the future. Jack Mitchell, our guest this hour as we entertain the question, where will radio be 25 years from now? Jack was director of Wisconsin Public Radio for a long time, and he helped develop the institution of National Public Radio and was the first employee and the first producer for All Things Considered, now in its 42nd year, I think. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley, who produced this program, and thanks for all of your calls. Leave more messages on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear how you answer the question about radio 25 years hence. News coming up.